Hi, everybody, and welcome to Martin Bandyke Undercovers for February 2019, produced in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library. This month's interview is with Chris Stamey about his new book, A Spy in the House of Loud, New York Songs and Stories. Pop music was in a creative upheaval in the late 70s. As the singer, songwriter, and producer Chris Stamey remembers, the old guard had become bloated, cartoonish, and widely co-opted by a search for maximum corporate profits, and we wanted none of it. In A Spy in the House of Loud, he takes us back to the auteur explosion happening in New York clubs such as the Bowery, CBGB, as television, Talking Heads, and other innovative bands were rewriting the rules. Just 22 years old and newly arrived from North Carolina, Stamey immersed himself in the action, playing a year with Alex Chilton before forming the DBs and recording the albums Stands for Decibels and Repercussion, which still have an enthusiastic following. A Spy in the House of Loud vividly captures the energy that drove the music scene as arena rock gave way to punk and other new streams of electric music. I began my interview with Chris Stamey by asking him how this book project came about and how long he had been working on it.
You know, the book started as a songbook. I was doing melody and lead sheet transcriptions of a bunch of old songs and new songs, and I started to recall things associated with those songs and made a couple of notes, and I was going to publish a songbook that had some interesting comments on the opening page of each song, and the comments part just grew and grew, and we severed them from the songbook and made them into this book. It was a little bit of an unusual genesis.
I'm such a dummy, too. I just had no idea that you lived and worked for so long in New York City. This is just a complete revelation to me. I really had no idea.
And, of course, when we say New York, that location has worn so many different cloaks. The time I was there was a real time of change, and it was very exciting. I feel very pleased that I could be there for those days.
Yeah, let's start there. What year was it when you moved from North Carolina to New York City, and what precipitated the move there?
Well, I'd been coming up regularly in the summers for years, either with my family or later on for Mitch Easter and I would come up from North Carolina and look for a record deal. Not that we knew what we were doing, but we would stay there for a few weeks with his dad and kind of soak it all in. But I really moved there in 1977, January.
Wow, and what a time to move to New York City. Wow. Hey, the rents were cheap at that time, correct?
Particularly downtown. I mean, there were ridiculous rents in Tribeca. There would be these huge lofts for just a few hundred dollars. You know, it still was higher than my rents in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, which is where I was coming from, but compared to what it is now, $3,000 for a one-bedroom or studio apartment, you know, yeah, you could. I think I was paying maybe $400 a month for a one-bedroom on Bleecker Street by the end of 1977.
Not bad, not bad. One of your early descriptions is of seeing the band Television, another group I absolutely revere. It took me, oh goodness, until the early 1990s before I first saw Television. I've only seen them one other time since then. What an experience this must have been. And take us into the first evening that you saw Television. Describe it for us.
Well, I saw them in 1975 before I moved up. And it was at CBGB's. They were playing a weekend with a band called The Planets. And I'd heard about them. In fact, I'd seen kind of strange, slightly geeky pictures in Rock Scene magazine. They definitely looked different than all the hair metal bands that were in Rock Scene magazine at the time. Rock Scene was something that Lisa Robinson was editing, I believe, and definitely a writer for. And it was a kind of glossy tabloid kind of thing that would be in all the drugstores in America. So it was strange to have television in there, but it made a lot of people curious, not the least of which was me. And when I went there, I thought it would be packed because they were an actual band in a magazine, but there were only a few people in the room, and including Hilly's dog, or not as a person, but anyway, Hilly's dog was there. Hilly, I think Patti Smith and Alan Lanier from Blue Oyster Cult were there, just a few people. And the music was great. I'd already seen a few late night New York things, Runson Roland Kirk playing, in the jazz world, and those were magical. But to see people doing something adventurous with electric guitars, that was really a vision. I mean, the name Television sure fit.
Yeah, so true. Gosh, I remember it was when they put out their third album, the self-titled album, when they finally came to Ann Arbor, and it was the first time I'd seen them. I think they played Detroit once way back when, I guess, in the late 1970s. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, they opened for Blondie and like an idiot at that time. It's like, oh, I want to see Television, but they're the opening act. They're not going to play that long. I wasn't the biggest fan of Blondie. I'll wait until they have a headlining gig in Detroit. And it never, ever happened. And then when I finally saw them, the Blind Pig here in Ann Arbor, don't know if you ever played here, it's still around, small club. And it was just, oh my God. I mean, it's just, that feeling that you're seeing something so truly special. Where were you musically in the mid 1970s then? Were you playing in the band Sneakers at that time?
Sneakers was one of the things I was doing around then. I mean, there were a lot of bands. We kept, we'd form a band and it'd last for 2 months in the summer. But yeah, I think Sneakers was going the last couple of years. I was in North Carolina. It was going before I saw Television, but I certainly thought that what Television was doing was great and tried to pull some of that into the Sneakers stuff. I don't think that's really apparent on any of the recordings, though. But, I mean, we were also seeing bands like, the Hampton Grease Band.
Oh, yeah.
Was a hippie band out of Atlanta that was doing very interesting things with guitars. Bruce Hampton became better known later in the jam band movement. But or there's a band called the Electromagnets that would play through North Carolina. Had a guitarist named Eric Johnson from Texas in him. So we were seeing people doing interesting things, but I think what I was really drawn to was I was in music school and being exposed to a lot of mid-century modern composition, and I heard elements of that in what Television was doing in the cross rhythms and the micro pitch effects, and it was exciting to me to hear more outside playing with the guitars I'd grown up loving. So I didn't really see it as a punk thing. I didn't see it as that related to the Ramones, who were great in their own way,
Talk about your work with Alex Chilton, and it was it right before the DBs formed that you worked with Alex Chilton, is that correct?
I should have been January of 1977, and he came, I think it might have been on Valentine's Day, but he came about a month later. Mm. And he stayed up there about a year and then came back a few times in 78 as well. I was going to play one show with him, and he ended up staying, and we played a lot, and we also recorded a lot, all of which has been lost.
Really?
But it was a year where this guy had only had a little bit of a peek into his psyche, I guess you'd say, through the Big Star Records. And when I actually met him, his thinking was way more multifaceted than I had would have suspected. And he loved all kinds of music. You know, we'd go see Charles Mingus play, or I mean, you know, listen to like Colin Blundstone records, or and he was writing a bunch of new songs inspired by his time in New York. So there isn't a lot of evidence out there of that time. There's a record I don't like that much called Lower Manhattan Ocean Club. That was our very first gig. I wish there was a live record from 6 months down the road from that. Mm-hmm. But it was a very... I really appreciated how kind he was to be patient with me and show me some of his take on recording and songwriting and his general aesthetic. I'm very, very grateful for that. He was a great guy.
I love your memories of working with the Golden Palominos, too, another band that I revere so much. And gosh, I'm a former drummer myself. I kind of left playing drums in bands in the late 70s and early 80s and then started playing music here in the Detroit Ann Arbor area since about 1983 or so. And the Golden Palominos are such an outstanding, just eclectic group, and so many great, great folks passed through there. I love your memories of Jack Bruce. Talk to me about working with the Golden Palominos and memories of Anton Fear and Jack Bruce and other people associated with that band, Chris.
I mean, Anton Fear has been a dear friend for a long time, and he's a fierce and opinionated guy, and I've learned so much from him, and I'm very grateful for everything I've done with him as well. I often disagreed with him at the time. Maybe I didn't always say that. And then later I would come to see where he was coming from and that he was right. Carla Bley had, jazz composer Carla Bley had done a record called Escalator of the Hill that Jack Bruce was on, and a lot of people was on. And there was a notion of a curated project like that, and now it's not that unusual. There are a lot of bands that are really only one person using a name, or perhaps my friend John Darnell in the Mountain Goats is an example.
Yeah.
It's always John in the Mountain Goats. Sometimes it's only him. Sometimes it's a full band. But Anton was doing that with the Golden Palominos, and he pulled in his friends from New York. Originally I was kind of a musical foil. I would help translate things. You know, I would sit there and Michael Stipe might be cutting a vocal and I would play the melody on the piano for him. Later Anton became more sophisticated as far as pitch and didn't need me to translate so much. But, you know, he would bring in, I mean, the organist would be Carla Bley, you know, or then it would be Bernie Worrell. It's incredible. Or to have Jack Bruce in there, because, you know, Cream records, things like Deserted Cities of the Heart,
yeah,
or I Am Still Free, you know, those were great and meant a lot to me growing up. But particularly Jack Bruce's record, Harmony Row, where he clearly was taking some broader musical ideas. I mean, there are a lot of whole tone scale melodies in there. There are these kind of collapsing rhythmic structures where things will be six bars, and it will be maybe eight bars, then seven, then six, and five. You could tell he was working with ideas and then translating them into, you know, very valid compositions. And then all of a sudden, I was on a bus with him.
What was he like?
He was funny. He had definitely been a rock star, but he was, you know, a very sensible guy. Mainly, he was a really good musician. I mean, all those folks were. He was musically very easy to work with. You know, sometimes, like, the members of, you know, the Funkadelic Parliament guys would show up, and things would get a little wild afterward.
Sure, sure.
He would step up to the mic every time and give it his best, you know, and that's really about all you can ever ask.
Let's talk about the DBs, too. What are some of your most special memories? What was, like, the highest point?
Most of my DBs memories, I think, are about being in the recording studio. For the first record, it's down in Soho in New York in a place called Blue Rock, and then moving up to Power Station where we met Scott Litt. Mm. And the whole scene at the Power Station studio, which became Avatar and then now is part of Berklee School of Music. But Power Station was a landmark recording studio. They were buying up the old gear that the other studios at the time didn't care for, so they had all these old Pultec EQs. Like 24 of them in every room. And they had a lot of influence from the owner, Tony Bon Jovi, who had worked as a kid at Motown. And so he was old school. And you felt like you were walking into a place where traditions were being integrated into new modern sounds. Not everything that Power Station did was perfect, but you know, Chic was in-house there all the time. Nile Rodgers, who's just a super musician.
Yeah.
And then, you know, lots of young new electric bands were coming through. So that was a whole experience for me, the first time I'd really been in a world-class studio. And then going to England, you know, last night I watched a Borg versus McEnroe. And that was those were the months when we were in England making the Repercussion record. The DBs were there. And I have lots of memories from that, but it brought back that whole thing of I got tickets to go see the Borg McEnroe final match.
Oh, my.
That's documented in the television program. And, you know, I think it was the Royal Jubilee that time. So we were, you know, it was a candy shop of us being in London making a second album at the Who's studio and then at George Martin's studio. But really what it comes down to is, you know, you're in a room with kind of stale air and a lot of soundproofing and looking at at three other people that you love and you've grown up with and trying to get the notes in the right place and do something that you all really are proud of, and that's the normal band experience, you know, but that's what the DBs were always to me, trying to open our ears and look at each other and play well together, and then it was a responsibility for me and Peter to try to bring interesting material and, you know, trying to bring something to rehearsal that would get a, oh yeah, or, you know, knowing or look from Gene or Will that, yeah, this is going to be cool. Probably my best times were in rehearsal. You bring a new song and it comes to life, or maybe it doesn't. But when it really clicked, I mean, that was a great feeling. And then when you'd go in the studio and it would come to life further, can't beat that.
Chris, let's close out. You're known very much too, besides being a musician, for your production work, and you've worked with some other incredible folks. What's been one of your happiest collaborations in the studio as a producer, past or closer to the present? Which one has been one of the more joyful experiences for you?
I've often liked working with people who are starting out, maybe who are making their first or second record. Let's see. Well, I mean, Ryan Adams had recorded some, but in pretty rotten circumstances. And he was always inspirational when I worked with him. We actually made a couple of records that have never come out and some that have. But we worked a lot together in his band Whiskey Town and sometimes just with him or just with him and Caitlin Carey. And he always felt like, we're here right now. Let's do something great. We can do it. And he also thought a lot of other music was really, really great. He had a great love of music in general, but he also was kind of fearless, or at least with me in the studio, he never really held back, and that was an inspiration or a reminder. I would also say working with a band called Le Tigre with Kathleen Hanna was a fantastic experience because she really held to a vision for every song, and if it was something she liked, it didn't matter if the sonics were a little funky or if you were combining very diverse elements. And she was very clear, but also very attentive, and would let me participate. And so those first two Le Tigre records, I don't know if people remember them at this point, but Kathleen and the rest of the band, those were a joy. I just made a record with a woman named Millie McGuire, and I think it's fantastic. Millie started working with her when she was 16, and she's now at the advanced old age of 18, and she's like an old-fashioned great singer. She walks in, goes up to the mic, she's done her homework, and she just nails it. And I've also done some live shows with her. We opened a bunch of dates for Alejandro Escovedo, and it was great to watch her do that thing where she opens her mouth and 30 seconds later, because of the quality of her performance, the audience is totally with her, you know. Mm. But that's kind of, I mean, as a producer, the best times are when you just kind of clear the ground, get extraneous things out of the way, make sure the key is good, the tempo's good. Maybe there's a part in the song that just isn't happening, and you suggest a little tweak in the arrangement, and then the music flows forth, you know, and it's fantastic. So that's probably happened with everybody I've worked with.
Thanks for listening to Martin Bandyke Undercovers for February 2019. Our interview was with Chris Stamey about his book, A Spy in the House of Loud, New York Songs and Stories. This has been a presentation of the Ann Arbor District Library.